Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders focusing on sustainable and impact investment and performance with purpose, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness in the market and highlight best practices in order to help more companies and institutions transition more capital into the industry faster. I'm JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time in doing this, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. Make sure you subscribe to get the notifications from your preferred podcast platform. And do follow us on social media to stay connected. We appreciate your support. It helps keep Impact Leaders going. Enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. I hope you are well, safe, and healthy, and that you are finding a way to manage the best you can during these challenging times. And hopefully, listening to this podcast will help you in a positive manner. So here we are recording a new episode, and today we have Ben Constable Maxwell with us as our guest. Hello, Ben. Welcome.
Hello, JP. Thank you for having me, and hello to everyone as well.
So Ben is Head of Sustainable and Impact Investing at M&G, leading the strategy of impact investing as well as covering sustainability issues such as climate change and the circular economy. He has been central to the development of ESG integration within M&G investment processes and has supported the development of ESG solutions for clients across asset classes. He plays an active industry role as a member of various sustainable and impact investment initiatives, interacting with companies, policymakers, NGOs, and other investors. He's also a trustee at Firefly International Youth Organization, which provides educational and mental health support for young people in conflict-affected areas in the Balkans and Middle East. Previous to joining M&G in 2003, Ben spent 4 years with the equities team at Invesco Perpetual. And he has an honors degree in classics from the University of Newcastle upon Tyne.
Thank you, JP. That covers some of the things that are certainly relevant. But yeah, thanks for the introduction.
Yes, and I know that the list of the initiatives that you participate in as well is quite long. So we may cover some of those, you know, during the conversation. And again, I have finally learned to appreciate, you know, the fact that people study in the UK, especially, you know, different majors, how then they apply it to their career is quite interesting. So, you know, perhaps, you know, you can, at one point towards the end, when we talk about you, you can share about the classics and maybe how that influenced you. My daughter actually likes classics, so it's something that caught my eye.
Does she? Good. Okay, well, I'm always supporting that.
So as it is tradition, first question is, what is sustainable and impact investing then?
I think it's changed, you know, morphed, developed over the years in lots of interesting ways. In my mind, it's really about a couple of things. There's an almost financial aspect to it, and then there's, you know, a, let's say, societal or sustainability angle to it. I think sustainable investing, ESG-informed investing, is really just the way to invest these days. I think it means that you take into account the relevant issues, the broad range of issues that face companies in different sectors and geographies. And I think it's just really about one level, taking a holistic picture and really informing your investment decisions in the optimal way, hopefully resulting in the best long-term investment decisions. So I think it's about better information resulting in better decisions. But obviously on another level, and this moves a bit more towards impact investing, you know, we believe sustainable and impact investing is about identifying major challenges the world faces, whether they're environmental or social or socioeconomic, and trying to find companies that are providing the solutions to those challenges. You know, that could be a renewables business that is working to address climate change and reduce or generate renewable energy and reduce carbon emissions. It could be a company that is addressing waste and pollution by developing more of a circular economic model, or it could be about companies that are maybe addressing a social challenge like inequality or limited access to communications or finance and providing a solution there. So it's about, I think, identifying challenges and investing in the solutions and supporting those solutions with capital. And we think that a huge amount of capital needs to flow in that direction away from, let's say, areas of the economy or areas of the market that may be causing the problems rather than addressing the solutions.
Excellent. And we'll come back to the specifics, I think, or maybe some of the examples that you can share with us, but also for the benefit of listeners, to for context and reference, I say many times, so let me share some background on your company. And of course, I recommend people to visit your website, which is mandgplc, which is mandgplc.com, which starts with a statement when you go to it on who we are. It says, you know, our aim is to grow our customers' wealth and improve their world by investing with care. And then it goes on to say that you've been caring for your customers for over 170 years, you know, ever since, people might know, but Prudential was founded as a loans and life insurance company in 1848. So they have sought to democratize, you know, wealth by helping as many people as possible gain access to your products. And then M&G Investments was established in 1931 with a similar mission to make the benefits long-term savings more widely available and introducing the first mutual fund to the UK. For those that don't know, M&G stands for Municipal and General, just a note aside. And the two companies actually came together in 2017 to form a kind of a new leader in savings and investment called M&G PLC. And the name changed, but the purpose remained the same, which is, you know, to help millions of people to manage and grow their savings so that they can live this life that they want. And then a couple more points for people to know. So M&G, obviously, as you may know, M&G PLC is a British investment manager in the UK and overseas, headquartered in the City of London, invests and manages in a wide range of assets, including equities, fixed incomes and real estate, and also other assets within the private finance arena, such as structured products, including CDOs, leverage finance, project and infrastructure finance. Just a note for those that, you know, do not follow the market, perhaps, say in 2017, in August, Prudential PLC, which was the parent company of M&G Investment, announced they would merge with the Prudential UK and European business to form the new division. The division would be called M&G Prudential, which then, I think if I understand correctly, back in August 2019, announced that it would demerge again the investment business as M&G PLC, which was completed at the end of last year. And then after the merger from Prudential, is now listed on the London Stock Exchange and is part of the FTSE 100. And then in terms of the operations, for that matter, currently M&G manages over 350 billion in assets on behalf of its clients. And the company serves 28 markets from 22 locations. And the very important point that brings us together today is that M&G extended its offering by branching out into sustainable investing. And in 2018, it launched the Positive Impact Fund, which is obviously one of the many reasons why we're here today. Mm-hmm. But you've been working with the company for a long time. So perhaps maybe you can share with us, you know, within the context of the large organization, what has been your role and what you have been doing.
Yeah, sure, JP. And thank you on behalf of M&G for that really good introduction. It was a complex process around, you know, taking two organizations and then sort of aspects of them merging and then the demerge from the parent company. I think it's given us an opportunity to, you know, forge our way as an independent organization. Really interestingly, I think it's an organization now that is an asset owner and an asset manager, which gives us some exciting opportunities about how to develop our approach and our products in sustainable investing and indeed impact investing. So it's a really interesting times and exciting times, I think, as well as super challenging times, you know, around the world on lots of different fronts. And so quickly, JP, I've been at M&G for 17, 18 years. And a potted history would be that I started in a sort of communications role. I started working with our global equities and European equities team. I became a what we called an investment specialist or product specialist. So I then spent a number of years working with the fund managers and the analysts in the global team and helping in particular to manage the relationship with our clients and with our internal sales teams, for example, communicating the fund strategies and performance. We spent a lot of time dealing with all the issues that the companies that we invested in experienced and faced as the global equities team. And I think I particularly worked on a couple of funds that were invested in, let's say, sort of industrials, mining and energy types of companies. And this was going back 10, 15 years ago. And not surprisingly, those types of companies were always experiencing what we would now call ESG issues. And, you know, at the time was still beginning to be called ESG issues, but issues around things like operational health and safety of a mining company, issues around potential spills that might occur at an energy company, issues around ensuring that the company would have a social license to operate in its local community, making sure its employees. So lots of ESG issues, and obviously governance was always central to the team. You know, we used to start any meeting with a mining or a oil and gas company. And I think lots of people did this, but a question around what was the safety performance? Was it improving? Had there been any fatalities? You know, those sort of just core, and that's an S issue in ESG, but we really saw it as a fundamental issue about the company's responsibility. And we always thought it's the right thing to do to ask whether, you know, how the company that we were investing in was performing. So we spent a lot of time thinking about ESG issues. And then JPI moved over to what was then our sort of corporate finance, corporate governance stewardship team, and did really with a mandate to do two things. One is to work with that team, which was primarily UK focused, but also had a bit of a global mandate, but to try and build up the global approach. I came from the global team, build up the global approach to ESG, and also to develop more of a focus on the environmental and social aspects within the team's traditional focus on corporate governance and, you know, broader stewardship. So I spent a number of years working with our investment teams in equities in particular, developing the approach to ESG and making sure the fund managers and the analysts were understanding and developing their thinking on the risks. And then a broad number of other people at M&G started focusing more and more on this and building up the support and the tools and the infrastructure. And then I sort of probably 3 or 4 years ago started focusing more on the impact side of things, because I thought that we had a great opportunity to develop some funds and develop our thinking on identifying the solutions, as well as thinking about ESG as a set of risks, as an, you know, investment risk-focused approach. So then I shifted towards impact, and I worked with a colleague of mine and a broader team as well, but a colleague of mine, John William Olson, who between us, we decided let's set up an impact fund based on a combination of his approach towards identifying sustainable business models and maybe my background focused on sustainability in more of a sort of societal, environmental sustainability perspective. And we joined up and we set up the Positive Impact Fund. And there's plenty more one could talk about, but maybe that's a summary of things. And one quick thing I'd say is, look, over that period of time, obviously things have changed an enormous amount. Yeah. And maybe we could touch on that on how things have changed over that period or how they're still continuing to change.
Yes. And maybe again, perhaps to share so that people understand. And I do, and I mentioned to you in the past as well, you know, I do like the numbers because it just gives a bit of context for people, but it's not all about numbers. Actually, it's a lot about, you know, the people and what you're doing to make different strategies and different asset classes to be sustainable or ESG driven or impactful, right? But I think you had mentioned, so I mentioned before, you know, you have an AUM of 350 billion. Then obviously you have been kind of analyzing the kind of the circular economy, which is one of the areas that you like and that you focus on, you know, to understand kind of the world and, you know, where you should be investing. And I know that you have different kind of sector areas and kind of different kind of overall impact as well that you have across, you know, your different asset classes and products and the firm. So maybe you can share a little with us about that.
Yeah, sure. As you say, let me say a couple of things and JP, jump in and push me if I'm not answering your question. But yeah, as you say, we're a big fund manager and we have this significant assets under management that we manage on behalf of our clients, both, you know, retail, wholesale, sort of direct clients, all the way up through institution and big institutional clients. And we always think at the end of the day, there is an underlying beneficiary or client, whether it's you're talking to a big institution or directly to one of your direct investors. And so I think, you know, it's really important to think about our responsibilities to those range of clients, irrespective of what the particular fund is. You know, we have a suite of ESG funds that cover different asset classes, whether it's in multi-asset or credit or private and liquid debt, and listed equities, you know, multi-asset, infrastructure as well, and real estate was one of the early leaders within M&G and really pushing a responsible investment and an ESG approach. And the assets under management that we have in specific dedicated, let's say ESG or sustainable or impact funds, is clearly significantly smaller than our broader assets under management. I have to say, I'm not sure exactly what the number is that we would describe, but it's in the billions, sort of coming up to 10 billion in terms of funds that are dedicated ESG mandates, strategies, rather than, you know, that 350. But, yeah. but I think that sort of misses an important distinction, which is that over those sort of 10 years, beyond that in many ways, but over those last 10 years, and in particular in the last sort of 4 or 5 years, the ESG integration program across M&G, starting probably in equities and fixed income to an extent, but actually now broadening out to all the different asset classes that we manage assets on behalf of our clients in. You know, all of them now, I would say, embrace and integrate an approach to ESG, because, as we said at the beginning, it's just the right way to invest. If you don't take, I think, an ESG approach and factor those risks and opportunities into your investment analysis and your investment decision making, you're just doing half a job. Because if you think about the issues that drive performance, the issues that really can cause major blow-ups, often they're ESG related in reality. You know, whether it's a sort of data breach from a cybersecurity perspective, whether it's huge spills, such as we've seen in companies in over the last 10 years in the oil and gas sector, whether it is a company, you know, sort of falling foul of a major, let's say, diversity and inclusion related scandal. You know, these things really hit the company's reputation. They also can hit the bottom line in terms of customers stopping, you know, buying the product or the service from that company if they don't believe that company is aligned with that individual customer's values. So we just think you've got to take all these factors into account across your investment suite, whether it's an ESG funds or whether it's right across your assets, right across those 350 billion. So we now say that we believe we have ESG integrated across all our assets at M&G.
Yes.
JP, I'd say that is by no means to say we've got it done perfectly and we don't still need to improve and learn, develop and use better tools, develop our tools. We're spending a lot of time developing our internal tools.
It's a live and ongoing process, isn't it?
It's a live and ongoing process, exactly. But the reality is, and we recognize this, that there are clients, and I think there are more and more of them, who would like to see a fund that they're invested in that is specific, or they want to select a fund that is specifically designed with all the appropriate exclusions, clearly articulated ESG integration program, and hopefully increasingly invested in areas that are focused on delivering solutions to some of the world's big problems, social and environmental. So we think we've got a responsibility to develop strategies that are specifically ESG or sustainable or impact focused, but we also think we've got a responsibility to integrate ESG right across a suite of investments and asset classes.
Excellent. So as I understand it, basically as a firm, you know, almost 100% ESG integrated, you know, you do have these specific mandates that are coming on the kind of lower billions, but still. And I know from the work that you have shared with me in the past that you are looking at the impact as well. So, you know, how much is having an overall positive impact. And then you have very specific so that people can maybe, I like breaking it down, this is for my benefit, but hopefully helps other people. Then you have the very specific product, which is the Global Positive Impact Fund, which now I understand has grown up to about 250 million, but still is pretty young. And I do know that you do a little bit of private there as well, but that's quite small as well. So does that summarize it?
Yeah, that's a good summary. I mean, the two quick things I'd say, yeah, the Positive Impact Fund, which is the fund we set up about just under 2 years ago, that, as you say, is still a very young fund. It's definitely seen really positive traction, I think, from a customer base a bit earlier than we would have expected, to be frank. But I think it's a great indication that the market and our customers want to be able to invest not just for good returns, but for positive societal, social, environmental outcomes. So that's super encouraging for us. And we, you know, it's a short period of time and it's early days for that fund, but we do think it's indicative of a growing appetite among our broad range of customers to doing something positive with their capital and their savings and investments. And just quickly on the private debt side, you mentioned, you know, M&G is a very big private debt investor, private and liquid debt investor. And then, you know, a number of our strategies naturally will be investing in companies that we would say have a positive net impact. Now, they're not necessarily in an impact strategy, but, you know, they would be investing in social housing programs, let's say energy efficiency, green buildings, renewable energy sustainable infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And two of my colleagues, Richard Sherry and Nicole, who now heads our a significant part of our fixed income business, they set up 3 years ago, so a year ahead of our Positive Impact Equities Fund, they set up a private and liquid debt impact fund, which, as you say, is similar to the Positive Impact Fund, is growing in size, relatively early days in illiquids, sort of, you know, that there is a slightly different approach in terms of the scalability or how it's scaling up. But that fund is seeing a lot of traction and gaining, and, you know, it was, I would say, quite a pioneer in an institutional context for positive impact. We call it Impact Financing Fund.
Yeah.
What we're also trying to do at M&G is to build on those two dedicated impact products, and there are some others that are linked to have impact characteristics as well, and broaden out actually our suite of funds that are able to deliver positive social and environmental outcomes for big challenges and also on behalf of our customers. And you mentioned a bit earlier, we do think we've got a role in helping to democratize or broaden the accessibility of impact investing, as well as doing a good job from a ESG and sustainability point of view.
Yes, yes. And this is interesting, so which takes me to kind of my next point around kind of your clients and what's changed in terms of what's really shifted, you know, in terms of how clients are looking at their investments. Anything in particular that you can share with us? And also, if I may add, this I think is the first instance where we have a guest that, you know, potentially you can talk from kind of an asset manager perspective and an asset owner, right? So you are a client and, you know, you have clients. So maybe that could be a two-part answer.
Yeah, one always has to be a bit careful about who, on whose behalf one can talk, but it's a really, it's a good point. I'll see if I can sort of make a comment about that. But look, broadly speaking, the appetite or the focus on ESG, I think it's considered to be a prerequisite. I remember 10 years ago, maybe a bit long, probably 15 years ago at M&G, you know, we started developing, we obviously had risk functions, but we started developing our investment risk capabilities and really building them out and really getting, you know, quarterly meetings or 6 monthly meetings with the fund managers on risk and what were the different types of risk in their portfolio, making sure there was nothing unintended, that the fund manager was on top of the risks that were in their portfolio. Of course, investors have to take risk, and but you just need to be aware and on top of. And I remember in those days, we used to go out to our clients and talk about our risk approach as well as just our investment approach. And that was quite new for the majority or a lot of our clients. Nowadays, you would core part of a fund communication is risk. I mean, you would never go out to clients and sort of with a fund without a very clearly articulated risk approach. I think ESG has followed that path in a little way. So nowadays, I think there's just, and it's happened quite rapidly in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, but it's been happening gradually over 10, 15 years. But I think there is an expectation from all of our clients now that sort of ESG is an important part of the process. There's been a real, I think, growing up in understanding of what ESG is. For a while, it was considered to just be ethical, just about avoiding controversial sectors or companies that are really beyond the pale in terms of their business ethics, for example. But I think it's shifted from that, which is what it was, I'd say 15, 20 years ago, to being now just a core part of the investment approach. So JP, I think our clients have just think it's now part of the approach. Where things I think have been developing in the last sort of maybe 2 or 3 years is I think this growing interest in sustainability. We're seeing the impacts of, I would say, problematic business and societal behaviours over a number of years and if not decades around things like biodiversity loss or pollution, whether it's air pollution or let's say plastic pollution in the seas. Clearly this sort of seminal global challenge of climate change, you know, all these issues I think have crept into the public consciousness in a very, very, maybe gradual, but very, very pervasive way. And, you know, we're now seeing a growing number of our clients wanting to invest in a way that addresses those problems. Certainly doesn't contribute to those problems, but actually increasingly addresses those problems. And that's where sustainable and impact investing comes in. And obviously, these things tend to start in the institutional channels. But then, you know, I remember, again, 5 years ago, we would talk about to our institutional clients about ESG, very rarely to our financial advisors or wholesale or retail clients. Nowadays, it's a discussion that we actually have with the vast majority of our clients. So it's morphed from the pure institutional towards much broader based approach. And then, you know, you asked the question about asset owner and the internal clients. So we, M&G, manages assets, you know, for the Life Fund, which is effectively our internal asset owner. And driven by, I think, partly just general things like regulation and, you know, client expectations, but also driven by some senior leadership sort of leaders at M&G and in our new company that exists as of last year, who really see this as a responsibility to get it right. They see it's also as an opportunity in the long term. If we're going to be a sustainable asset management company and a sustainable investor for the next 5, 10, 15 years, this now has to be done and we have to do it right. And I think that's that joined up approach, which is really exciting, I think, for us, which is, you know, it's not just external clients, but actually if we can drive sustainable outcomes and focus more on impact from an internal point of view, that is a really exciting opportunity. And as I said, I think it often, and we can talk about it with other companies, but I do think that you do need to have a leadership willing to put their neck out and say, this is crucial for us. This is part of our strategy. This is the future of our organization. And I think if you get that leadership, and we've got a few at M&G who really have taken that stance, including sort of CEOs and heads of research and heads of distribution who are driving this throughout the organization. Yeah. So it's not just the ESG team. It's got to come from the leadership.
This is a kind of across sectors, but, you know, very much in the news for those that watch Formula One. So you had Honda kind of stating that they're going to come out of Formula One at the end of next year. And it's all on the back of the strategy from the top. You know, where that it just doesn't go anymore. We know what they stand for, which is, you know, becoming net zero by 2030, I think, if I recall correctly. And, you know, going into electric cars, et cetera, et cetera. So applies across sectors, right?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Of course it does, JP. And, you know, we could talk about loads of really great examples, you know, companies that have really embraced a transition. And I think, you know, I think companies now just seeing it almost not even from a leadership point of view. I think companies are now seeing this is a survival issue, whether it's in autos or whether it's in energy or whether it's in utilities or actually right across sectors and right across geographies. Certain geographies are ahead of the curve. But I was just going to say that that confluence of increased risk to your business model and then the senior leadership change often, which happens. And we saw it at, I don't know if we can mention names of companies, I imagine we can, but, you know, we saw it at, you know, some of the oil and gas companies. In particular, I remember it so clearly with, as many others, BP, which was, you know, a big company, obviously, in the oil and gas sector. And we were part of the engagement program with Climate Action 100 Plus with the company. And, you know, there was longstanding engagement about an intention, which was a different strategy. Yeah. And then when the chief executive came in, so you had a chairman and a CEO, and then increasingly a broader strategy team that really recognized the risk, saw the writing on the wall a little bit, understood from investors that this was important, saw the role that they could play in society. And then that's what really triggered, I think, a big, big change. And I'm not saying that there isn't a huge amount of work still to do, but that was a really strong indication that you get those external factors, but you need that internal leadership to drive change.
Yes. So kind of overall as well, the message I pick up is that basically the shift is, you know, which is a message across, you know, a few of the podcast episodes, previous episodes, which is, you know, the shift to looking at beyond not just the purely financial kind of goals, right? So the sustainability of the models that then affect by all means the financial goals. So if we move into kind of identifying and measuring impact, you know, you have done obviously a lot of work. You know, you launched kind of the positive impact strategy in 2018, and you'll be doing the work across ESG, across the firm. Is there anything that you can share with us in terms of, you know, your framework, perhaps something of an example so that people can picture it, you know, how you apply it?
Yeah, of course, JP. So I think in impact, you know, we see the sort of tenets or the principles of impact being around intention, certainly, and that's partly about the company's intention, but also the investor's intention, but also the underlying investee's intention to address, solve a challenge. We think materiality is really important. So, you know, it's about getting a significant proportion of the company's business focused on that solution, not just a small 5%, 10% of the company's revenues in terms of that kind of business. You know, the additionality of impact investing is a crucial concept. And, you know, we could talk about that for hours, but it's, you know, what does the company do that's transformational, that is bringing scale and technology and solutions to the problem? And but also, you know, how can you play an additional role as an investor as well? Really important. But look, measurability, I think, is probably one of the defining factors that differentiates impact. And so we think it is crucial It is the proof in the pudding. It is the demonstration that the company is walking the talk, or we as an investor are walking the talk. And it's a challenge, right? And I think we believe that you've got to do it, and you've got to strive for better measurability of the impact. So the way that we do it in our Positive Impact Fund, just maybe as an example, we have a framework, which we call the Triple I framework, which we developed, but sort of, you know, supported by lots of others input into it, where the first I is the investment. So we focus on the quality of the business model. We want a company to be there in the long run, delivering whatever it's delivering, which in the fund's case is a sustainable solution to one of the world's big challenges. We think the intention is the second I, and that's all about purpose and clarity of purpose and authenticity and delivery of that purpose right throughout the organization, not just PR, but genuine. And then the third I is the impact. And for us, what we do is, and a core part of that impact assessment is whether it's measurable. So you can have a company that we know is delivering a fantastic impact, but you just don't have the data. And we think that is, in a sense, okay. So we've got a couple of the companies, a small number of our 30 companies on that fund, where we do find it a struggle to measure the specific impact according to a KPI, which we've set. Mm-hmm. And we want the company to report on. But we think that if you had a whole portfolio of companies where we say, yeah, we just know the impact's there, but we can't quite measure it, we think that would be problematic. And by the way, for those small number of companies that where we can't perfectly measure to a, not perfectly, we can't do our best to measure, we say that's actually a challenge for us to get that company to report better. So we spend a lot of time engaging with those sort of relatively small number of companies that we want to push them to improve. But really for us, and so that's the bigger picture, the specifics very quickly is, you know, that we have in this fund, we have six impact areas, three environmental, three social. For each of those six impact areas, we have a set of rules, like two or three rules that determine whether a company can make it into that impact area. And then we have a set of KPIs that are linked to the SDG targets or the IRIS Plus KPIs from the GIN, the Global Impact Investing Network. And we think every company, ideally, we can measure the positive impact they're having relative to that primary KPI or primary and secondary KPI. So we think that that holds us to account. It gives us something to measure the company's impacts on. And that could be, by the way, sort of millions of tons of greenhouse gas emissions avoided by the company's actions. It could be sort of virgin material, use of virgin material avoided versus an alternative, you know, in a circular economy business model. It could be things like millions of trees saved by, you know, a recycling process that specifically avoids the use of virgin forest, which is, you know, increasingly, I think, a crucial role. And it could be millions of people who from underserved communities who have access to financial services product for the first time, and or who have access to a healthcare solution that is affordable and helps improve their livelihood. Now, we are aware that in that impact assessment, sometimes we're measuring outcomes rather than ultimate long-term impact. So, you know, someone receiving or having access to financial services when they didn't previously, that is, I would say, an outcome. We're then pushing for the impact KPI, which is how is that person's life improved? How is that person more likely to have their income increased from a level that is just on the poverty line, maybe to, you know, more comfortably above the poverty line? And what benefit does that have for them and their community and their family? So, JP, it's a really interesting area. We find it fascinating. It's also really complex. I would quickly say we certainly, nor does I think much of the market, we certainly don't have the perfect answers. But we do think aiming towards better measurability is a really great mechanism for improving the outcomes for the underlying people and underlying issues. So we spend a lot of time pushing for improvements. There's more that one could say, but I think I'll leave it there for a second.
No, I thought that was very useful. Thank you so much, especially as you put into kind of palpable examples, right, on the KPIs and the differentiation between the outcome and the impact, which, you know, sometimes I like the example again that you gave. Can I just double check? So the three I's, which one is the first one?
Investment.
Investment, intention, impact. Perfect.
Exactly, yeah. An investment is about sustainable investments, really, as in sustainable business models, good companies that are going to be here for the long term delivering.
Yes. Which then helps me kind of think about kind of linking the methodologies, the measurement kind of with the commercial aspects, right, for the investee, so the company you're investing in, and for you as a fan, right? And we were talking about this before in terms of, you know, how you are also changing the way that you're looking at investments from kind of the framework of, you know, finding the purpose, impactful businesses with kind of this, I think you mentioned to me offline before, the moat, you know, this defendability, but now you're looking at it, you know, a lot more holistically.
Yeah.
Just, you know, from a business perspective, and can they defend the business, or can they defend and sustain over time and help society around them, right?
That's right. You know, I think if you look back sort of however many years, and actually this was part of lots of investors, the kind of Warren Buffett approach focused on, you know, moated business models where the company has the competitive advantage that, you know, it's very hard to encroach on, and, you know, you don't want necessarily a monopoly, but having an oligopoly or a duopoly strengthens the business case and it makes that a super strong business, and it means that no one can compete with it. It's a real survival of the fittest, kind of real competition type of perspective. I think that was quite a prevalent view for many years, and I think it's still very prevalent. And it makes sense from a pure investment point of view. But I think when you shift towards more of an impact mindset and more of a purpose-led mindset, I think you have to shift that focus on competitiveness. And I think you want to invest in sustainable business models that are, as we've said, going to be there for the long run, because there's no point investing in a company where you think is going to deliver long-term impact if that business fails or dies or collapses. You want to see strength and a decent competitive position so that the company can protect its patch, so to speak. But actually, you want that company to be, you know, purpose at its core. So you want that company to be succeeding in order to do the best job in addressing the challenge. So I think you can tell a lot about why how a company talks about its goals. You know, does the company say we're here to protect our IP and we're here to sort of have this competitive position, which means we can sort of maximize the pricing and maximize our, maybe over the shorter term, but maximize our margins? Or is it actually, it's important to generate returns and profits for our business and to keep us sustainable and to keep us viable and actually to reward our shareholders and our employees. But you want it to be a bigger picture. You want the company to have purpose at its core. So it's, as you say, JP, it's a nuance. It's not a complete transformation necessarily, but we think that broadening that moat out to be more of, I'm sure there's a really neat analogy I could use or an image I could use, but it's more, rather than it being moated, you want the company to be, you know, supported by a range of different factors, its range of stakeholders, but also you want the company to be supporting those range of stakeholders. And we think that is actually what drives really long-term sustainable success. And by the way, you know, so we partner with we should work more because they're a great organization, but we work with the Access to Medicine Foundation. And, you know, that is an organization looking at big health care and pharma saying, look, you guys are here to solve the world's problems. And I think their value has been really highlighted during this COVID period. But actually, you have a societal role. Your role is not just to protect your business, to protect your IP and generate supernormal returns. Actually, your role is to help solve healthcare challenges and help save lives. So it takes a bit of a mindset shift. And I think, you know, we've seen controversial blow-ups where companies are just protecting their margin and trying to make as much money out of a drug. We think it's a more nuanced approach.
So on that note, so if we think about, and as we start kind of coming to the end, if we think about the future, right, and, you know, kind of given the scale of the challenge, you know, and let's say from the SDG perspective alone, so do we need to, and I'm going to quote something that you mentioned to me another time, which was, do we need to redesign capitalism to deliver kind of the E and the S outcome and impact, right? That we should deliver, and how do we do this? That's kind of the many trillion pound question.
Yeah, cool. Okay, well, nice to have an easy question to steer us towards the end. Yeah.
Well, this is something that also, you know, I am very big about, and, you know, this is kind of what I do and why I set myself to do what I'm doing, which is the whole point about, and I talk about collaboration, you know, so I always use the phrase, you know, together we're stronger. And then it's something that, you know, resonates with you because you told me, like, that's kind of the first thing that we need to do, which you are actually doing a lot by participating with all the different initiatives. So maybe that's one that we have definitely a common, we share an interest and actions.
Yeah, I agree, JP. So collaboration and partnership, I think, is definitely one of the main concepts or approaches that we all need to embrace if we're going to address these issues properly. I mean, I think it is interesting, just even in my sort of relatively short period of time in my career or in working in finance. And going back to that previous comment we made on the importance of moving from a just competitive, moated approach to more of an open-minded, how do we kind of get together to partner for the solutions? I think the financial services industry is used to be very competitive. It's all about how do we deliver alpha. I think it's still about that. That's important to deliver the best returns we can for our customers and clients. But there's much more of an, I think, open-minded, collaborative approach. And that's sort of really indicated by organizations like the Climate Action 100 Plus initiative, or whether it's the impact management project in more of an impact approach, the Investment Association in the UK, but the PRI, all these initiatives are like collaborative partnerships, which is really, and I'm not saying partnerships didn't exist in the past, but there is a recognition that to address the scale of the challenge that we need to address, you need to do it with others. And I think that that's definitely one step. And I think you're going to get much better results in working out what the solutions are if you pool brains in organizations and, you know, will and assets in organizations across different sectors and geographies. By the way, it's not just, I think, investors working together, it's investors working with governments and policymakers and companies and actually our customers. I mean, you know, I think it is a holistic piece. But also I would say that, so what does that collaboration result in? It results in trying to work out in more of a thoughtful, scientific, solutions-focused way, what do we need to change? And I think, you know, engagement is a really important aspect of things. We need to just engage and demonstrate our responsibility to our investee companies or our investments. You know, when you've got the global wall of invested capital pushing in a similar direction, that's super powerful. And we're doing that on behalf of society, on behalf of our clients. That is very powerful, I would say. But also, I think it enables you to think about particular pinch points where maybe things have gone wrong. And I think two quick things I'd mention. One is, I think this focus on purpose is really, really important and powerful. If you think about a broader approach to stakeholder capitalism or just stakeholder sort of responsibility, and you say a company is not there just to deliver a return to its shareholders with a view that that also helps maybe its other stakeholders, but actually the company should really genuinely be thinking about its responsibilities and represent its responsibilities to its customers, its employees, the environment, the future, actually, its future kind of customers, the future generations. I think you really sort of shift the view, and I think that is very important. So I think a shift from more of a shareholder primacy perspective to a stakeholder responsibility perspective. Obviously, lots of people are saying this at the moment, but I do think that is a powerful mechanism. And then the other thing is, I think you start looking at the tools that we have, whether it is accounting principles or, you know, sort of more granular traditional approaches to investment and analysis. And once you start reshifting or reorienting those, and I think the reason I flag that is that I think for example, the impact adjusted accounting approach, which says we need to have a new accounting system for the 21st century and hopefully beyond. We need to get together to agree the principles, work out how to do it, and then roll it out across the investment chain. Then you're starting to your question, we're starting to reinvent or reimagine or reset the approaches that we currently have in place, which I would say most of us increasingly think are not quite fit for purpose, or maybe some people say are not at all fit for purpose. So I think it's a combination of partnership, working out together what the problems are, and then targeting some really central problems, whether it is the purpose of an organization, or whether it is how do we account for impact in our analysis. I think that's sort of a long-winded answer to your question, JD.
Yes, totally, totally. I think, you know, I go back to that point about how do we, you mentioned, I think, how do we change the behavior, right? So how do we, it might like inspire behavioral change, but in some cases force it. And I think that, you know, definitely inspired by, you know, collaborating, working together. I picked up, I think, in one of the videos, I can't remember if it was with IMP or Gene, a working group, you know, everyone that joined, a few people said, oh, well, I didn't expect this to be, you know, what it was. And it was so positive and good. And I looked at it from different ways. And again, people sometimes underestimate, you know, the power of, and again, just getting together with the different stakeholders. Mm. And then, you know, like you mentioned as well, so part of the reporting, the standards, the disclosure, you know, also for the KPIs that you need to achieve, and all the things that you mentioned in terms of, you know, the impact adjusted accounting, which is the Harvard Business School, I think it was George Serafin, I think.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. And then obviously you have, SASB, which we talked a while ago, from the ESG kind of risk materiality. You have the kind of the Global Reporting Initiative. And then I mentioned recently as well about the Big Fours, joining with the Business Council, Business International Council, I think. And so there's a lot happening and coming together, I think. And obviously, we haven't covered in this case in detail, but with the kind of EU taxonomy and the defining, the basics of defining, the economic activities, which is something that you raised as well on another conversation, which is, what is sustainable and what is not, right? And which is going to basically define what is an attractive investment or not attractive or uninvestable or too expensive, which, brings us back to, just to start closing to, the commerciality and the sustainability of business and society and the world overall. Perfect.
Yeah, JP, you've, I think, just done a quick whistle stop through the broad range of issues that the world's facing, or the investment world's facing. And I think you've done that really, really nicely there. There are so many issues. It's such a rich area for discussion. And I've had some really super interesting discussions with you over the last few kind of months or weeks. And as you say, it's hard to kind of bring them all into this particular discussion. But just quickly to your point, I think on that behavioral change, I think it's crucial. It takes sort of signals and leaders. There have been people who have been really pushing this area and sustainability, environmentalism, responsible and sustainable investing for decades, actually. And I think kind of often it's a gradual process, but it seems at the moment to have to have some really unstoppable momentum.
Are we at an inflection point, you think?
I totally think we are.
At last.
But you never know, right? But it seems that we're definitely at an inflection point. Now, an inflection point, clearly, you hope it moves in the right direction. But I think inflection points are the point at which also not just things hopefully change and improve and move in a positive direction, but at the point at which I think things can go wrong or they can go off in the wrong trajectory. And I think it's incredibly important for everyone working in this area and policymakers to make, the right decisions and to make well-informed decisions and not to just take the opportunistic path. And I think that's why so much concern about greenwashing or impact washing. I totally share those concerns. It's an amazing moment. People talk about the, green recovery or the great reset or build back better or whatever the phrase is, right? It is a genuine opportunity, particularly, I think, post this terrible crisis we've just gone through, but actually for all sorts of other reasons, that all this collusion of factors that give us a phenomenal opportunity. A, it would be a terrible tragedy, a real wasted opportunity if that is wasted. There's always a risk that it'll get wasted. But B, it will be, it would be incredibly damaging, actually, if positive moments gets, let's say, diverted or hijacked and gets sent in the wrong direction towards, just good PR or good stories. Or, I think it's a moment for real change. And I think everyone working in this area needs to try and make sure that the change happens in a authentic and a correct and a, ethical way, rather than that momentum and that opportunity being lost. And, which is why it's, I think, really interesting to talk to you and talk to your perspective, hear your perspective. But the inflection point definitely doesn't mean we're out of the woods. I think it probably just means that work is really properly beginning to make sure that the right direction is protected rather than the momentum being lost.
We had to take that next leap, right?
Yes, exactly.
The phrase that I'm going to that I stole from you and I'm going to use for this episode, I think, which is, we had to go for it, right? So, which brings me to the final question, which is, what is your final call to action then to listeners of the podcast and to the various stakeholders that you mentioned?
Yeah, it's a tough one because it's very difficult to issue a call to action. I'm certainly not the right person to do it. And we, all of us working in this area, I think have strong views. I would say that in my mind, and I think increasingly across the industry and certainly among many at M&G, we are dealing with some really phenomenal challenges that are sort of hugely risky from an investment point of view, but also from a societal point of view. And I think if we do go down the business as usual route, we won't address them and we'll end up in 10, 15, 20, 30 years in real trouble. And I think we have got this amazing, we are at this inflection point, and I think the stars are aligning in many ways. And I think the call to action would be, let's partner with as many relevant people that we can to create a coalition, to which there are many coalitions out there already, but, you know, to create this coalition that is focused on working out, using all the different tools that we have at our disposal and using all the different channels to work out how we support, promote and invest in the solutions, rather than just continuing on a pathway that doesn't work. So yeah, it's an opportunity, but it's an opportunity that comes that will be effectively delivered if we all work together and really keep laser focused on the fact that we've got these challenges and we need to find solutions to them.
Perhaps in other words, it could be about joining an existing coalition or a relevant group that represents you as a stakeholder. That's kind of what I heard. Perfect. Thank you so much, Ben, for your time and for every insight that you have shared with us. It has been a real pleasure.
JP, thank you for having me. We've had some really good discussions and I've really enjoyed all of them, including this one. Hopefully that's been of interest.
Yes, I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will. And for many more. So it is bye for now and until the next episode of Impact Leaders. And God bless you all. Please remember to check our sponsors' websites for upcoming events. Thanks.
Great. Bye, JP. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILA & Partners and Fast Forward 2030. Please connect with us at ILA & Partners for advice on how to transition into sustainable and impact investing. And go to fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models.